And for those of you that are new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial for how to use this podcast. When you hear the bell ding, that means that you should look on your device to see what paper we're referencing to back up what we're saying. But if you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether or not you want to take it or leave it. Welcome, everyone, to this one-hour distraction to your drive back and forth from Phoenix to Tucson we call AZMCast. It's April, which means the allergy season should be full in effect. However, most of those allergies are usually precipitated by some complaint of sinus infection or a cold or something else. Doc, you just gotta give me something to make me feel better. Do you love Z-Packs? Me neither. Do you think that they're actually good for anything that's out there? Me neither. Do you give them? Yeah, me too. So we decided to delve into the Z-Pak mystery and mythology and see what it's good for. We used to use Z-Paks for all kinds of stuff, and now its efficacy for some of the common complaints, such as sinusitis, ear infections, bronchitis, has kind of gone away. But like all drugs, what is old is now new again, and it's being repurposed for some pretty interesting stuff. Now, I apologize that the recording quality isn't what we normally strive for, but it gets better over time, so bear with us. Whether you're a lover or a hater, Z-Packs are out there, and your patient knows about it. So listen to us as we kind of comb through the literature on azithromycin and discuss pros, cons, benefits, risks, and all about the do-everything, do-nothing drug that is the Z-Pak. All right, after much ado and way too much setup, we've got our crew again today. We're going to be talking about medical myths, maybe, possibly some medical truths, but we'll get into that in a sec. We've got, for our April episode, Brian Drummond is back.
Hello, Aaron. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. We've got Chris Williams again.
You can call me C-Dub today because we've got another Chris in the house.
And we have another Chris in the house that we've missed. We haven't had for a long time. James Harden, the beard himself, Dr. Chris Edwards, pharmacist, ED pharmacist extraordinaire.
It's good to be back, man.
Nice. And sellout.
Yeah, he is an Italian.
You'd never recognize him. You clean up good, except for, like, you know, right here.
The real man.
Oh, man, everything else. You've got, like, the perfect, you know, I try to take care of myself, except for right here. I just am free and wild. C-Dub had you beat up until a couple months ago. So what we're going to be talking about today is something near and dear to at least my heart around this time of year, which is Z-Packs.
Mm.
Yeah.
Z-Packs, bubblegum, Tic Tacs.
Flintstones.
Flintstone vitamins, go-away medicine, however you want to phrase it. Z-Packs are very, very common. Z-Packs are something that are given out all the time for a variety of needs because I think back when they actually came about, they were good for all kinds of stuff. Right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. Prior to the emergence of different resistance patterns, azithromycin was a useful drug for a lot of different indications, and now maybe not so much.
And not just because of its efficacy, but it was really easy to write for and really easy to take, and so you had improved compliance as well.
And it had a great name, and yeah. So name brand, I think, sold right. A lot of...
If you add PAC to it, like Z-Pak, Previpak, these make it easier. Yeah, yeah, Medrol Dose Pack.
Yeah. It just sounds good.
So it was an easy drug. You would take it for 5 days. There's not a whole lot, except for maybe cystitis, that you can treat with 5 days worth of antibiotics. It was easy to take. You only took it once a day. And you took a big dose at the beginning, and then you took 4 smaller doses subsequent days. But it wouldn't just be done in 5 days. It has a pretty long half-life. Is that correct, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of an interesting drug. It actually goes intracellular and sticks around for a really long time. Huge volume of distribution. So, you know, you get that intracellular antimicrobial effect for much longer than the actual amount of time that you're taking the drug.
So you give it to him. It sticks around for a long period of time. It sounds like a great drug. So we started giving it. It was effective against otitis media. It was effective against pneumonia, bronchitis, chlamydia, pertussis, infectious diarrhea. I mean, all kinds of stuff. It was a great drug. And its off-label uses, if you look it up on Micromedics or some kind of pharmaceutical reference guide, its off-label uses are everywhere. It's off the charts. You can use it for all kinds of stuff off-label. But its actual FDA-approved uses are more for above-the-diaphragm infections.
If you go out of the country, its actual primary use in places like Nepal, for example, are for diarrheal illnesses. Very, very common. It's got the greatest efficacy for that than even for like a URI indication.
So, great drug, and like all great drugs, we abuse it as quickly as possible, and it seems like we've burnt out Z-Pax to a fair amount, but that hasn't stopped us from continuing to prescribe.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So, Z-Pax aren't as efficacious as they used to be. Chris was noting that the efficacy now is not as good. Current resistance to strep pneumo?
It's over 35%.
Wow.
So over 35% of the strep pneumo isolates that we have here in Tucson are resistant to azithromycin. So not a great drug for treating anything caused by strep pneumo.
So one out of every three patients that I'm treating with a Z-Pak is not going to get any better.
Exactly.
All right. So it is still good for some things, and there are a handful of things that it's still really, really good for, even though we still give it out for all kinds of things. I think Z-Paks are probably burnt out for strep pneumo, they're burnt out for otitis media, they're burnt out for pneumonia, just because the literature kind of shows that. But it's still good for my favorite ED infection, chlamydia.
Absolutely. So if it's good for one thing that we take care of in the emergency department, it's chlamydia. But pretty much only chlamydia. So I mentioned earlier that azithromycin does tend to cause resistance in organisms pretty quickly, and that's what happened with gonorrhea. So there was a short period of time where people were using azithromycin to treat gonorrhea.
The two gram dosing?
Yeah, the 2 gram slam. But gonorrhea got wise pretty quick and figured out some resistance mechanisms to sidestep azithromycin. So there are a fair number of isolates of gonorrhea that are now resistant to azithro. So that 2 gram slam is really kind of a last ditch effort, which sucks because it's a cool sounding option, right? If you can give somebody 2 grams of azithro and kick them out, don't have to give them a shot, it should work. But the emergence of resistance among gonorrhea isolates makes it kind of useless.
And the 2 gram slam is likely how they got the gonorrhea to begin with.
Well, that's definitely getting edited.
Maybe. So one of the papers that I saw referenced that azithro is about 97% efficacious compared to the gold standard, which is a week's worth of doxy. What was funny in the paper, though, is that in order to prove that, they observed somebody taking doxycycline twice a day for a week to make sure that they actually took it all and then didn't have any treatment failures. With the single-dose azithro, they observed them taking a single 2 gram dose. They didn't note how many people vomited afterwards, because all my patients seemed to. But they said that they had about 5 treatment failures with the azithro group. Now, in real life, no one's looking over your shoulder to make sure that you're treating your chlamydia. So I think 97% is pretty good. And the whole reason why we give it in the ED is to watch them do it, to do exactly what they did in the paper, because we can't look over their shoulders.
So if they gave it, they watched them take the full gram of azithromycin, 97% efficacy. If they watched them take 14 doses, okay, 7 days worth of doxy, they had 100% efficacy. But the authors go on to say that if you only got 10 or fewer doses of doxy, then there's a 20% failure rate there. So you just have to really wonder if your patients who are who may or may not be trustworthy are
questionable decision making.
Thank you for putting that more eloquently than I was about to.
It's better than what I said previously.
Yeah, so that exactly right, and I think that's why we still use it rather than just everybody getting doxy.
Well, I think this is an interesting question because I still like to use doxy in this case. Why? Because I kind of feel that they need to be in the penalty box for a little bit, meaning no sexy for you for a while, partly because I want their partners treated. Mm-hmm. So when I give them that one-time dose, they're like, oh, good, I'm cured. I'll go have more sex and pre-pick up the disease. So I'm trying to give a cool-down period. Now, they may not take all the doxy, but I try to say, all right, you need to take your doxy, and then your buddy needs to take their doxy, and you both need to take it easy, then you can get back going. But you don't want to keep passing this back and forth. Now, again, whether they're going to or not, that's up to the patient.
And then you're relying on both of them to be compliant.
Correct.
I don't know.
So it's you know, to me, it's I'm trying to play an odds that I don't want them to get the disease right back. Now, yes, the zither will hang around longer, but there's, you know, we're playing mind games with patients, too, in our treatments, and I think we'll get into that a little bit more. So I think there's not a wrong answer. I think both work. Doxy is probably the better drug, but in terms of compliance, that's what you're looking at is your balance. Am I going to get compliance or am I not?
And just to clarify, we are talking about urethritis, right, not PID?
Right. So the CDC guidelines for sexually transmitted infections recommends that you can use azithromycin, a single dose, to make sure that you're actually treating lower tract disease, so urethritis, cervicitis in women, urethritis in males. However, if you have upper tract disease, if you have epididymitis or chitis in males, if you have pelvic inflammatory disease in females, now we're talking about a more prolonged course, more prolonged treatment. And the CDC is pretty aggressive as far as treating PID and STIs because they really want to try to wipe this out all in once if they can. So they say, kill it now. If you have a clinical suspicion, if they've got cervical motion tenderness, they've got adnexal tenderness, they've got uterine tenderness, and you can't find another source, just treat them. And I'm pretty liberal with giving azithromycin to somebody that I suspect might have an STI because I'm not really all that worried about what it's going to do to my possible appendicitis unless I really think they have appendicitis. I'm not really worried I'm going to partially treat a UTI. I'm pretty certain that this patient that I've done a pelvic exam on has cervicitis, so I'm going to treat them.
And I don't want to take too much of a departure here, but if you'll allow me to get on a little bit of a soapbox, when you do that and you're aggressively empirically treating for an STI, please tell the patient that you're aggressively empirically treating for an STI and you don't know for certain that that's what they have, because they go home and it results in an awful lot of accusations that may or may not be valid. So that it's very important that they understand that you have no diagnostic certainty. You're just trying to be very careful. I've seen that blow up.
I make sure to tell them to change their toilet seat.
And no more hot tubs.
No more hot tubs. That's why they have to use that little paper hat thing in the public bathrooms. So everybody agrees, chlamydia, azithromycin, they're a match made in heaven. So give azithromycin bountifully to those who may have risk of chlamydia. And another kind of my soapbox or my little clinical pearl is if you've got a fair amount of white blood cells on a urinalysis in especially a male who doesn't necessarily have signs of a UTI, think that this might actually be chlamydia. Nothing's going to grow from it. Nothing else is going to show up. They either gave you a very poor clean catch specimen in females or in males that are uncircumcised, and you got a little bit of the flora that's just around the skin or around the genitals. But think, maybe this could be chlamydia. Ask a couple of those uncomfortable questions because, hey, you work in the ER. Hopefully, you're never going to see this patient again, and you're a doctor. They immediately trust you with details like that that they would never tell even their partner. So, all right, so chlamydia, check. Pertussis is the other one. I think that if we just put azithromycin in the water, we would rid ourselves of pertussis and chlamydia. Add a little Zofran in there, and, you know, life would be so much better. So pertussis is another indication. Have you guys ever had a pertussis scare where someone's put you on a Z-Pak before?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Working in peds, it happened a fair amount of where you'd have a positive test and everybody would want their azithromycin. The issue with azithromycin and pertussis is that even though it kills the Bordetella pertussis bacteria, it eradicates it from the host, it has no change in their clinical symptoms. So if you've got a especially a kid, but even an older person who is an older adult or just a teenager that's got pertussis, you're not going to change their clinical symptoms. So it's still important to figure out that if they have pertussis, they still need to be treated so they don't spread it and you get an outbreak, but it's not going to change their clinical course, which I think most people are going to expect when you give them magic antibiotics.
Does it reduce the duration of symptoms?
It does not. It has no outcome whatsoever on clinical course.
Just transmission and spread.
Mm-hmm. And the pertussis vaccine is really the reason why we give a tetanus vaccine. People are scared to death of getting tetanus, but nobody really cares about pertussis, even though I've seen a lot more pertussis than I've seen tetanus in my lifestyle.
Or in your life.
Yeah.
With my lifestyle of, you know.
I think that was the previous thing.
Yeah, that was the previous
one. He's a coffee sneezy guy.
Even though I've seen a lot more pertussis than I have tetanus in my lifetime, which is zero tetanus. I've seen one botulism and zero tetanus. So treating patients with vaccines to try to help get that pertussis coverage is really the benefit of it. We try to revamp them and get them treated again. We covered this on the podcast a few years ago, that the pertussis vaccine wanes after only several years, and it's not very good even after a year or two. So you got to make sure that you're vigilant to look for it. So pertussis in smaller kids, they'll have that staccato cough. They'll often have color change with cough, and they'll have that inspiratory whoop, especially if you're taking a board question. The problem is once they get to that stage, you're way behind. They've already got all the problems that they're going to have with it, and it's best to treat them when they're in the prodromal stage, where they seem like they have
a URI.
A URI. So, azithromycin for all URIs, right? No, if you treat them ahead of time, then it's worth it. And many people will advocate for just empirically treating patients who are in close contact with somebody who had pertussis. It's probably overkill, but pertussis sucks. For adults, pertussis can make you cough up blood. You can crack a rib. You can, I think people even burst pneumos from coughing so much. It is an intense cough, and you try to do everything you can to prevent it. There was another article that we found that was, does azithromycin help you if you just have a chronic cough? This was an interesting one where they just tried to see if it would help chronic cough in general. So they took 44 patients, not a whole lot of patients, but enough, and they gave them azithromycin 3 times a week for 8 weeks just to try to kill whatever was in there. And these were patients that had already been coughing for 2 weeks. They'd already looked to see, is this GERD, is this asthma, or something else? And the amazing part about it is after receiving azithromycin for 3 weeks, they were no better. And then receiving it for the full course, they were still no better. So antibiotics aren't going to cure everything. The thing I take from this is that I tell parents and patients right away when they have a cough, I cannot fix your cough. In fact, no one can fix your cough. The only true cough suppressant is succinylcholine.
Works every time.
There is no other method to treat your cough. And any of the residents that have worked on shift with me, you can zone out for a bit, but I always explain to parents that your cough is your protective reflex. You have J receptors in your lungs. I don't tell parents that, but the residents know that you have J receptors in your lungs that are just tactile stimulus. And if you get something in your lungs, you aspirate some water, you will cough until that receptor is satisfied and you are done coughing. So it's all that mucociliatory escalator to get stuff out of your lungs and get it out. So I warn parents, no matter what I give you, you will continue to cough. I tell patients, no matter what anybody says, they cannot cure your cough. You just have to cough until you're done coughing.
One thing in that study, though, they did a little bit of a subgroup analysis, though, and determined that it might have a place for cough associated with asthma, which leads us to this other article that you have with azithromycin in WARI, right? Wheezing associated respiratory illness. And I love that the authors on the end of that said further research is needed to disentangle the anti-inflammatory versus antimicrobial effects of azithromycin, which opens up a whole other indication or potential indication for azithromycin, which would be all of its anti-inflammatory effects.
So have you guys ever taken a Z-Pack personally?
Yeah, plenty of times.
Yeah? No. How do you feel when you're on a Z-Pack?
Like my respiratory infection's improving? Because I believe in the power of placebo.
Yeah. I have lots of people tell me that they feel better after a couple days of a Z-Pack. Yeah. And so my first thought is, no, you don't. You're full of it. This is placebo effect, whatever. There is actually some literature to back up some anti-inflammatory effects of Z-Packs. There's even one paper, wasn't very well done, but it showed that it actually decreased the viral load of rhinovirus. Mm-hmm. It's an antibiotic. It's not an antiviral. Why is it doing this? It's got some anti-inflammatory
cures what ails you.
That we just don't get.
And wouldn't you know it, I have a history of asthma. It was worse, much, much worse when I was a kid than it is now. But I believe that because of its anti-inflammatory effects, it's probably helped me a bit more than maybe your general lay population.
Then the question is, should we be just giving Decadron or prednisone to these people?
And I'm fine with that.
As opposed to like the side effect of anti-inflammatories. It's the whole like statin argument you hear sometimes here and things. Oh, there's some anti-inflammatory component with the statins. Well, maybe we should just give our coronary artery disease Decadron with their aspirin.
So this was kind of a cool article that was... it was done in kids age 1 to 3.
It was like a randomized RCT.
Mm-hmm. And they took 158 kids with like asthma-like episodes, which for those that aren't familiar with like the outpatient diagnosis, you're not really supposed to be diagnosing asthma until they're older than 2. So 1 to 3 is a pretty good age group. They took half of them and gave them azithromycin, and the second half they gave them placebo. And the mean duration of the episode after treatment with azithromycin was 3.5 days versus about 7.5 days. So they actually got better 3 days faster. That's pretty significant. The reduction in the episode was about 83% if they started treatment before 6 days of illness. After 6 days of illness, didn't really help much. So they said that it actually does reduce the duration of illness for kids with wheezing-associated respiratory illness.
So one thing to consider, though, is that this is a Danish study, and they have different resistance patterns there. They didn't go as far as identifying the different microorganisms that they thought might have been the culprit. So whether these were mostly viruses or whether they had more atypicals there, and they have much, much less resistance than we do in the United States to azithromycin. So it's also possible that the azithromycin was just more efficacious because it is more efficacious in Denmark. And then the other thing that we were just talking about is these children were also treated with the other things that we would do for anyone who's wheezing. They got corticosteroids, they got inhaled steroids, they got albuterol beta agonist. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, one of the thoughts of maybe why this works a little bit better, I don't know about the 1 to 3, because typically we say this isn't supposed to happen, but mycoplasma pneumonia, the walking pneumonia that causes first-time wheezing in someone who's never wheezed before, that's one of the typical atypical pathogens that we're trying to treat with azithromycin. So is it that these younger kids, this WARI, is actually some kind of atypical bacteria that's treated well by azithro? I'm not quite sure. But we know that mycoplasma, if you see somebody with a cough and bullous meningitis, you see somebody with erythema multiforme and they've got focal lung findings, you kind of consider maybe this is mycoplasma. So do you treat mycoplasma or do you tell them, well, you're going to get over it anyway?
I treat it.
No, you don't treat anything.
If it doesn't start with a Haldol, I'm not giving up. So, I think it depends on what their symptoms are. You know, if you're seeing an infiltrate on an X-ray, you know, an age group that you're thinking this is maybe an atypical pneumonia, that's different than, say, if someone comes in with runny nose, cough, ingestion, and they've had it for 2 days, I don't think I'm going to go looking and say this is a mycoplasma if their chest X-ray is normal and give them a...
Yeah, the more symptoms that they're having, the more likely it is that it's viral. And if the symptoms, if it's just cough, maybe a little bit of productive, maybe, you know, fever, but not much else, and it's been going on for more than 4 or 5 days a week, I'm much, much more like, more apt to call it an atypical and then treat it.
Right. Well, and I think that's right. And that's where you're looking more for. You know, I think you're going for more bacterial when you're starting to get fever, cough, longer duration of symptoms after, regardless of the X-ray findings. I mean, if it's a day or two of symptoms, I think even with a normal X-ray, I don't think many of us are going to throw. Well, many of us should not throw antibiotics, in my opinion, at these patients because they haven't even defined their disease process. It'll just give them some time to.
Some of the community docs that listen to this podcast may be able to chime in later, but I have worked at places that have rapid mycoplasma testing. So I've worked at a place where I could just check for a rapid myco and know if they had it.
Interesting. I wonder what the carrier rate of mycoplasma is.
Yeah, I didn't. I literally did no thought process into it. When I found out I had the test, I just started ordering it. I never looked into the test characteristics whatsoever.
It'd just be an interesting, because where else is the disease coming from, right? We're passing it back and forth, so there's got to be some carrier population, like any of these things. Right. They're picking it up from something. So who is that, and do they get disease more often, or they just carry it?
Yeah. I did it to justify my azithromycin prescription. It made me feel better about it.
Test positive, give antibiotics. Test negative, you have virus. So mycoplasma is one of the ones that we can treat, and it's still, azithromycin is still recommended for community-acquired pneumonia. It's not recommended anymore as part of monotherapy. So trying to use it to treat mycoplasma, H flu, strep pneumo is not really going to be efficacious, and that's the Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines for treatment of community-acquired pneumonia. They recommend if you're going to treat, you use some kind of a penicillin or a fluoroquinolone in addition with azithromycin, but you can't use just the azithromycin by itself.
Yeah, that's right. So basically they recommend adding atypical coverage if you're going to cover someone for community-acquired pneumonia. I don't know if it's just the lack of faith from the IDSA and people being able to differentiate atypical from bacterial pathogens or common bacterial pathogens, but they say if you're going to treat... they do still say that if you happen to live in an area where you don't have endemic strep pneumo resistance to azithromycin, it's still a valid monotherapy. But there aren't a lot of people who live in the U.S. who live in an area where there's not a pretty high rate of resistance of strep pneumo to azithromycin. So they recommend using something like a oral third-generation cephalosporin, ceftonir, something like that, in combination with azithromycin to give you that atypical coverage. Alternatively, you could use a respiratory fluoroquinolone by itself, something like levofloxacin.
I don't know where these places are that don't have like high resistance of strep pneumo. Because I figure, you know, Tucson's not, it's a pretty landlocked place. You got to really travel far to get here and there. And like, where are these places where you don't have a high rate of strep pneumo and you can still like lick some mold and treat your pneumonia?
Denmark.
New Zealand. Yeah. Since we can change our resistance pattern just by our usage pattern. So if you stop using an antibiotic, the resistance drops dramatically until it's reintroduced as a mainline drug for that indication. And you'll see that places with UTIs too. They change their resistance for a few years. They get maybe a couple years of Bactrim and then they stop using it because the resistance goes up.
So I have another hardball question for you, Chris.
Bring it on.
It's when we find that there's an antibiotic that seems to work really well and is aggressive enough without being outrageously aggressive, we go with it because we don't have to think about it.
Right.
So a perfect example that I'm seeing now is the use of ceftonir. We throw ceftonir at URIs, LRIs, UTIs, and feel good about it because we don't have to think about it. What's your thought?
It's only a matter of time before we'll have to start thinking about it more. So, you know, the problem with putting pressure on any bacterial species is that at some point it's going to start to figure out mechanisms of resistance, and you're going to start to lose that drug.
So would you recommend that if someone comes in and they don't have a ton of comorbidities and we're doing outpatient treatment for community-acquired pneumonia, we stick to...
You can talk me into doxy on that, particularly now that it's... The price of doxy was exceptionally high for a few years. Basically, it was only being sold by one drug manufacturer, and they knew it, so they gouged people and just charged them way more than that drug was actually worth. when you send somebody out with a script that's going to cost them a couple $100 to fill, they're probably not going to fill it. You're not doing them any favors.
But that's been fixed now?
I believe that the price has started to drop now. Yeah, so I think that for these things like community-acquired pneumonia, other things where doxy is a reasonable option.
What about other macrolides in our area? How about clarithromycin or erythromycin?
So a lot of the mechanisms that confer azithromycin resistance also apply to your other macrolides. So in this type of situation where we have a very high rate of azithromycin resistance, I wouldn't expect other macrolides to be very useful, unfortunately.
And if they have some degree of comorbidities, I still find myself throwing Levaquin at a lot of people, levofloxacin. Am I a bad person?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a good option. Fluoroquinolones have some side effects, and that's sort of the reason why people have been shying away from them. You know, if you have somebody who's got a lot of comorbidities and they happen to be, you know, elderly, you know, you may want to consider doing something different. But for the most part, I think a short course of levofloxacin for community-acquired pneumonia is probably going to be pretty well tolerated.
I try not to do it for everybody, but if they have, you know, COPD or they have diabetes, it's poorly controlled, rheumatoid arthritis, I typically find myself just going to my bag of Levaquin.
I think that's probably a pretty reasonable approach to this. It's one drug treatment, and it's going to cover the pathogens that you want to hit. You've got pretty good rates of susceptibility with strep pneumo to respiratory fluoroquinolones. That's sort of the difference between your respiratory fluoroquinolones versus Cipro, is the respiratory ones give you good coverage on strep pneumo. Cipro doesn't.
Last question.
Yeah.
Augmentin.
Ah, yes.
Is that one that it seems like old school that's new again for respiratory infections, or is that one that we should look at as second line to something like levofloxacin, or would it just be equivalent?
So that's kind of a tricky one. So I don't think that we're currently testing susceptibilities of strep pneumo isolates to augmentin.
Yeah,
so it makes it a little bit challenging to say definitively whether or not it's a good option. I know that our amoxicillin rates of resistance with strep pneumo are starting to creep, so fewer isolates are susceptible to amoxicillin, and I'm not sure if the clavulanic acid's enough to overcome the mechanism of resistance that strep pneumo is inducing, so I'm a little bit leery about using it as monotherapy, particularly if you're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted a different placebo to send somebody out on instead of a Z-Pak, maybe it's an option. But
well, I think that the summation here is, in a sense, community-acquired pneumonia, doxy or levoquin would be your one and two, and you can flip-flop them around depending on what you want. I think azithromycin is a great third or later choice drug, but it probably won't treat their pneumonia. If you're in the peds population, I would do a high dose of mox still as my primary. Again, I'm not worried if they have mycoplasm, because if they have that, they're still going to get better. You know, there aren't many atypicals that kill people on a regular basis in that 5 to 25-year-old population. So that's my overall takeaway on how I use antibiotics for this age group for community-acquired pneumonia.
Here, Brian.
Yeah, that's good.
And for the inpatient pneumonias, you know, we still got to consider the bad things like Legionella, which that's a great indication for azithromycin or one of the respiratory fluoroquinolones. So chlamydia, pertussis, mycoplasma, I mean, those are pretty solid indications for where azithromycin would be helpful. The other two that are good indications are most bacterial enterituses and strep pharyngitis in patients who are penallergic.
Indications that we'd want to use azithromycin for, don't use the Z-Pak dosing, right? So if you're going to use it for chlamydia, you're not going to give 500 milligrams once and then 250 for the next 4 days. You're going to give them 1 gram at a time. It's still pretty useful in patients who have immunosuppression, HIV, with a low CD4 count, and you want to treat them empirically for Mycoplasma bacterium avium complex, MAC, if you want to prophylax them for MAC. But again, you're not going to give them the Z-Pak dosing. You're going to give them 250 three times a week. So that Z-Pak dosing regimen just doesn't really make it. It's not something you're going to use often in the modern world of resistance.
What you're saying is don't write for Z-Paks, Chris? It's okay. You can say it.
That's it, man. Don't write for Z-Paks. Azithromycin still has the occasional role, but that dosing is probably not right.
I don't know if you're using the foghorn or the turkey stem, but
turkey.
You're going to probably need like three of them for what I'm about to
do. I have a turkey.
turkey blowing a foghorn.
Foghorn, leghorn.
This is a good segue for just my total 100% anecdotal experience. Okay. So I grew up the son of a family doc, internal medicine trained, but he did primary care and works in an urgent care. Okay. So I grew up, anytime I had, like, I sneezed twice, I had, you know, like, Avalox shoved down my throat. Okay.
And I asked my dad how he prescribes azithromycin, because I know he still does. And he gives 500 milligrams Q day for anywhere from 3 to 7 days. I said, why? He said, well, I kept having enough resistance with the Z-Pak, so I just started going up on the dose, and everyone's happy. He said the PC, he gets the benefit, which we don't, right? We send people home, he gets to see them again. And his is 100% anecdotal, but his anecdotal kind of empiric experience is that with that higher dose of azithromycin, he is seeing people getting better faster, not having the resistance that he was seeing before, which is the Z-Paks. Thought I'd throw that out there. To add one tiny little bit of anecdote to that, personally, I have also done that over the past year. I had one bout of a URI that I treated like a virus, because I'm pretty sure that's what it was, and then I got, like, what I'm pretty confident was a super infection of bacteria, because I got acutely sicker, started having, like, nastiness, took a azithromycin, but I was on vacation at the time. I didn't have a Z-Pak. All I had were 500 tablets, and so I did what my dad's been doing, and it cleaned me up pretty fast, and I don't know, I obviously didn't compare that to a Z-Pak, so I don't know what would have happened with a Z-Pak, but that's my N of one, and don't do what I just said to do, but I just thought I'd throw it out there, and, you know, if we're getting resistance, then it makes sense to just go up on the doses.
I mean, that's kind of interesting, and some of this might come back to the anti-inflammatory effects,
right,
versus the antimicrobial effects, and then, you know, how many of these things would have gotten better without treatment. Are you just making someone feel better because you're giving them big doses of azithromycin? It's kind of hard to say without... randomized control trial.
No, it's interesting you mention your dad's trifecta of I work in a urgent care, family practice, small town, because that's you know, kind of the Z-Pak staple. You know, it's like, oh, it's you. But
well, yeah, that study that this is where you're headed, maybe. But that very large scale study, they basically were able to capture something around 75 to 80% of all prescriptions around the country, and then they have a little computer program that models it to 100%. So based on that, they determined that counties with high proportion of obese patients, infants and children, that makes sense, prescribers per capita, so if you're competing with other people, you're the one giving the prescriptions, more people are going to come back to you, and the more females, you're more likely to give azithromycin.
So the interesting part about it...
And location.
Yeah, the interesting part about it to me is we kind of, you know, are looked at as emergency doctors as you are the ones burning out azithromycin for the rest of us, you know? So all you ER doctors that are out there, ER doctors were fifth in prescribing behind family practice, who is number one, and pediatrics, who is number three.
And dermatology.
Mm-hmm.
And ENT.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this goes back to what you were saying, you know, with emergency medicine, you don't see these patients again all that often, hopefully,
yeah.
Right? With all the specialties that you listed, these are your patients. They're people that you know well, and, you know, you want to keep them happy. If they come in demanding a Z-Pak, you're probably more likely to do it.
Now, this was not just Z-Paks. This was all antibiotic prescriptions. However, Z-Pak was the most commonly prescribed antibiotic of any antibiotics during this time frame. What I think is even better, physician's assistants were number 8. Nurse practitioners were number 12. Go, nurse practitioners.
If you're in the south, the southern states, you're much, much more likely to be handing out those antibiotics. Us in the west, I guess we can consider us the west, we are actually pretty good at being a little more stingy with our antibiotic prescriptions. And I thought it was interesting that they said that there was an association with lower socioeconomic and education. And it kind of made sense to me. And the reason is, if you have a well-educated kind of patient who understands what you're about to tell them and you explain to them the concept of antibiotic resistance, they seem to accept that a little bit more. And if their eyes kind of glaze over and they don't really follow what you're saying with, it's just a lot easier to write the stupid prescription.
Get them out of there.
And if you've got if azithromycin truly does have the anti-inflammatory effect we're talking about, and they feel better after taking a Z-Pak, they go, look, I don't care where you went to school or what kind of research or whatever you did. I've taken a Z-Pak. Every time I have this, my doctor gives me a Z-Pak, and every time I feel better after about 3 to 5 days. It's real tough to argue against that. So now it's your word versus mine. I'm the one with the pen. You're the one with the press Ganey score.
Well, and the Z-Pak's on the Facebook and the Pinterest and all these places. And so, I mean, the interesting thing with the longer duration that you had mentioned, Chris, is I end up not prescribing. I don't like azithromycin. I think it's a second-class world drug. But if I need to give a macrolide, I actually give clarithromycin. Why? For 10 days. Why? Hopefully their illness is done by 10 days. And because I see the 5-day course of a Z-Pak, they have a virus. Someone threw azithromycin at them. And so they're starting to take the Z-Pak, and day 7, they still have a cough. And then they come back to see me in the ER and Army, and I'm like, you know, how you doing? Oh, I finished my Z-Pak, and I'm still feeling, I still got this cough, doctor. And you're like, all right. If you had 10 days of an antibiotic, you wouldn't be back here to see me. But if you had 5 days, it ends too early. Now, again, this is all mentally treating placebo effect, but it is, right? If I'm still taking actively a treatment, I may not come back because I know that I'm still being treated. Now, that's very, like... I have no evidence for this, other than I'm playing psyche more than medicine half the time.
I don't know. I still have plenty of patients, especially college students, who are, with all due respect to college freshmen, you are overgrown toddlers. I was an overgrown toddler. That's one of the most difficult populations to take care of. Doctor, you don't understand. I've never been this sick before. And then you talk to mom, who's in Sheboygan. She's like, no, he's never had a fever before, ever. You two need to get together. He needs you to just hold him and tell him everything's going to be okay. All right.
I believe it was described to me as really horny toddlers.
Horny toddlers.
That's the difference between toddlers and college freshmen.
Well, that's definitely getting edited. So I have had them come back the very next day and say, I was put on antibiotics yesterday and I'm not any better. So no matter what you give your patient, I don't care if you give them a drink from the Holy Grail from Last Crusade, they are still going to need some education about what to do next. Writing the prescription does not get you out of having to have a human connection with your patient. Sorry about that. The only thing that does that is to not work again for another 2 weeks after your shift. We've talked about some of the benefits, some of the areas where it doesn't help anymore. But of course, azithromycin is on a patent, and the patent runs out at some point. And at that point, things start to come up, such as the risk of QT prolongation and sudden cardiac death in patients who are taking azithromycin. Brian, I think this is your this is where you step in. I'm going to play the tinfoil hat music.
Yeah. Well, I think I kind of hinted that to me, like, there's some A drugs, right? There's A words, but I have A drugs, and azithromycin is one of the A drugs. There's two good A drugs, aspirin and albuterol, but azithromycin, it to me is a, there is a better drug than that. So it's a second indication for every indication, right? So if you tell me an indication where I think I could use it, and we've talked about, yes, you could use it for STDs and stuff, but I still think doxy is probably a better drug. The issue is compliance, and you have to play that. But if you were going to tell me COPD exacerbation, Z-Pak, I think there's a better drug. We've already talked about community-acquired pneumonia and doxy. Even mycoplasm. I mean, when do we really I diagnosed you with mycoplasm. I don't remember putting that on a diagnosis sheet recently. Now, maybe you do. Maybe you have a titer and you got a test. test, and you called it that, you know, I think that's, but most of us don't have that test. So if we go through any of these indications, there is a better drug or a better antibiotic, and for the, all the viruses that we treat with azithromycin, it's called other symptomatic care. And as Aaron was hinting at, patient prognostication, shall we say, you know, ma'am, I'm so sorry you're sick. These things are miserable. It's probably going to last 10 to 14 days. I don't want to give you diarrhea, yeast infection, a prolonged QTC, or a sudden death. You don't want to die from these antibiotics. Some of these are very scary. So let's just get you feeling better and a note for work for the next 3 months. And
works like a charm.
You do have to be careful when telling them the serious risks, because at some point they may actually need that antibiotic. They go, no, I had a doctor tell me one time that that thing kills people. I actually had a 83-year-old lady that I was taking care of that came in for chest pain, and she's very spry, very with it, her very mentally alert, and she said, you know, doc, I think my chest actually hurts because I was doing physical therapy and they were making me do all this upper body stuff because it hurts right here. And I go, well, you know, the only thing we would do is we would figure out if you need stents. She goes, stents? Those things kill people. Don't you know that? Like, hey, you're going my direction downstream. That works for me. So let's get you going home. So there was a study. It was a New England Journal study where they did a lot of retrospective look to see that there is an increased risk of cardiovascular death in patients with azithro compared to penicillin type antibiotics. What's interesting is that it was not that difference between azithromycin and levofloxacin. So these are drugs that we know prolong your QT. So what I'm always aware of before I give somebody just the random Z-Pak or the antibiotics or whatever I'm doing is, are you on methadone? Because I can tell someone, hey, don't take this medicine for a little while. Don't take that one that I know prolongs your QTC. And they're probably going to do it. If you're on methadone, you're not missing nothing for your methadone.
Gotta get my drink.
That is the most likely antibiotic medication interaction you're going to find is methadone. The only time I've ever seen torsades was methadone. So always ask about that. Realize it is a real thing. Another interesting thing was we talked about treating all the contacts for a patient with pertussis. There's an increased risk of pyloric stenosis with azithromycin if given in the first month of life. You know, I can't think of any time I've ever prescribed a Z-Pak for a kid that young. There's some competing evidence that says maybe it's not the same because for the anti-inflammatory effect, again, some NICUs are using it to try to help boost lung function and try to prevent some of the bronchopulmonary dysplasia. So it's a little bit competing. But again, it's kind of like an x-ray for a chest x-ray for a pregnant woman of like, you know, you're pregnant. You probably don't want this x-ray because I don't think it's going to show anything. And it's a lot of radiation versus, oh gosh, I think you probably have a pneumo. We should really get this checked out. You need a chest x-ray right now. So use it how it suits you to take the best care of the patient, not just to be right.
Well, I think that, you know, we're talking about antibiotic prescription in general, and a lot of us don't have the fear of, oh, just give them an antibiotic, right? It's this common, just give it to them. And we have this kind of same discussion about intravenous fluids in the emergency room all the time, right? Oh, just give them some fluids, but then there's backlash, like, oh, you're giving too much fluids, right? So all these things have true harms and true benefits, and what we really need to do is apply them appropriately to a patient that would benefit, and if the benefits outweigh the harms, I think that's the person you want to do it for and have a good indication. Don't just willy-nilly, oh, I just want to get them out of here, I'm going to throw this at them, because there are some significant harms, and if you do that enough, you will hurt those patients, as opposed to having it, like you said, Aaron, a conversation or just sitting down and talking with them about what you're wanting to do. And also, with antibiotic prescriptions in general. I think trying to minimize them is probably a good thing. Why? We're not getting any new antibiotics. We don't have anything new coming out. The only thing new in the last 5 years that I can think of would be things like tigacillin, you know, or Teflaro, and some of these, you know, fourth or fifth generations of a class we already have, but we don't have any new classes. So I try to reserve the antibiotics, hopefully lower the resistance for when someone truly needs them, and then give them so that they will have an efficacious effect.
So, you know, and the new and upcoming reasons to use azithromycin is like the wheezing-associated respiratory illness. Maybe it'll actually help. Cystic fibrosis patients and patients with bronchiectasis are using azithromycin on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or even a daily basis to try to help stave off exacerbations, and it's effective. Whether it's the anti-inflammatory effects or antimicrobial effects, not quite sure. The one that I thought was most interesting is the patients that are use azithromycin on a daily basis to prevent COPD exacerbation. Now, I haven't seen a whole lot of COPD patients that are on daily azithromycin. Have you guys?
Never. I haven't seen a single one.
Oh, I have. Yeah, I've seen several.
Mm-hmm. So that would be something that would kind of jump out to me of like, oh, why, you know.
And I don't think it's daily, right? I think it's like 250, three times a week or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's three times a week and then there's daily. But most of them said, the study that I saw said that they had to take it for a year before they saw any benefit. And the difference was slim. It was 1.4 exacerbations versus 1.83 exacerbations. But, you know, that's not nothing. The thing that was actually more striking, well, so they came down to a number needed to treat of 8.
Right.
To prevent one person from having a COPD exacerbation.
Over a period of time of?
Over the period of time of a year. This was a Cochrane review that was done that looked at a bunch of different RCTs, 3,000 patients, and tried to put them all together as a systematic review. And they said continuous daily antibiotics reduce the amount of people that had an exacerbation. But for how long, I think, is what you're asking of, are these people that have been on it for a year or people that have been on it for 10 years, and what are we seeing now? Because COPD patients live longer than a year. They live a long time if we take good care of them, and we don't want to cause them other issues. They did say, though, that it didn't affect the number of deaths in any cause. It didn't affect the frequency of hospitalization or lung function, but there's always the concern of antibiotic resistance.
A lot of these studies, though, excluded people that were at risk for QT prolongation.
Which, of course, is appropriate. And you know, we have lots of antibiotics that we use for off-label stuff. Erythromycin is one of the reasons no one will take it is because it gives you horrible diarrhea. So if you've got bad GI motility, erythromycin is wonderful.
Well, and it's interesting with these kind of things, right? If you've excluded a certain population that you know the harms for, it'll show that your benefits even more so. But to take, even if it's a number needed to treat of 8, to put 8 people on a year-long course to prevent one exacerbation without changing hospitalizations, mortality, or lung function.
And quality of life is what they eventually got down to.
Right. And so that, you know, those are the things that I think you really have to look at. How much, you know, what's the cost of that drug versus, you know, one more time a year when you have COPD, and what does it change?
Yeah, we have to be a little bit honest if we're talking out both sides of our mouth. We don't give azithromycin to people prolonged. I mean, you're going to contribute to antibiotic resistance, and we have to be, you know, cautious with this. And azithromycin is not really good for anything anymore, so, you know, it doesn't really matter. So you probably don't want to give it because it doesn't work. So
that ship has sailed, though. That ship has sailed. I think azithromycin, if you're just trying to treat a bacteria, probably not helpful. But as we've talked about, this is a drug that may have other uses and different mechanisms of action, and not just antimicrobial.
But so we just sacrifice it for antimicrobial effects, or anti.
We're using it for off. We're using it for its side effects or other reactions than what it's truly for. And maybe it's in a chronic disease state. I mean, we talked about with HIV or AIDS patients with, you know, preventing MAC episodes. I mean, maybe that's kind of what we're doing this as, and just saying that we know there's resistance to it, but maybe in these sicker populations, this may benefit them. I think that's kind of what we're discussing.
you wonder if this is going to be one of the repurposed pharmaceuticals of like, hey, guess what else we found this does?
Yeah, new FDA indication. All of a sudden, it costs a lot more now.
And then they repatent it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's, well, but only the 300 milligram dose. 250? Yeah.
Right. 250 doesn't work.
Oh, no, never, never. 255.
400. 450.
Just remember, we called it here in April of 2017. Azithromycin is going to be the new naproxen.
Can we pin down this whole concept of sudden cardiac death and QT prolongation? I hated that article, but I hated that article because it had some really compelling data that may buck my paradigm. And, you know, every time I hear about the QT prolongation, I say, well, everything prolongs your QT. I'm throwing Zofran at people, narcotics, and, you know, fluoroquinolones, and everything's prolonging their QT. So, you know, azithro is just like that. However, in this study, it went from, I think, a placebo, in the placebo group, 29 per 1 million people had a sudden cardiac death. And then their other antibiotic that they use as a kind of a separate control, if you want to think of it that way, is penicillin. That was almost about the same, about 30%. And then azithromycin was 83%. That was pretty compelling, had a remarkable p-value, and I'm wondering if I should I start worrying about it? So is that something, how would you recommend that we go about our azithromycin? Kind of what checks and balances should exist in my head as a clinician when I'm thinking about throwing azithromycin at somebody? I'll tell you, when I finished that article, I thought, well, you know, for the times that I might consider giving it to a kid, i.e. when the mom asks for it, I'm not going to worry too much about it in that situation. But the older the patient gets, more comorbidities or other drugs that this may interact with, when is that?
That's the trick. Okay. I mean, I think really, as Aaron mentioned earlier, you know, methadone is sort of one of the big players with QT prolongation, but there are a ton of different things out there that will prolong your QT. You know, you mentioned a few of the big players with this, ondansetron. You would never do it, but I would never use this in combination with fluoroquinolone. If somebody's on psych meds, so your antipsychotics, particularly your typical antipsychotics, but even your atypical antipsychotics can cause QT prolongation. I would really consider risk benefit when you have multiple agents on board that can prolong the QT. As a lone agent, somebody who doesn't have a history of congenital QT prolongation or anything like that, probably not an issue. But when you start getting more and more of these additional risk factors for causing QT prolongation that eventually may progress to torsades, I'd start to be a little bit more cautious at that point.
Summary time.
Don't use the Z-Pak.
Done.
Think it's about it in chronic disease later when someone else makes that up.
So just to summarize, Z-Pak is given for lots of different things. How good it's going to be is definitely changing over time. So we've got some antibiotics that have really held the test of time. Penicillin for a lot of stuff. Amoxicillin for a lot of stuff. Vitamin R. Ceftriaxone for a lot of stuff. Azithromycin's utility is probably waning. Probably no longer good for otitis media, sinusitis, pneumonia, and viruses, except for maybe rhinovirus, which would be fascinating. If someone
makes you wheeze, maybe, right?
Yeah. So what it is good for, it's definitely still a great drug for chlamydia. It's definitely still a great drug for pertussis to at least prevent spread, but maybe not so much to treat the actual illness unless you get to it ahead of time. It's still good for mycoplasma, legionella, some of the atypicals. It's good for some of the bacterial enterituses for Shigella, for Salmonella, for Campylobacter, and strep pharyngitis in penallergic patients. Those are all still pretty good indications. It's not without risks. You have the risk of QT prolongation that we talked about, you have to be concerned with. Don't think that every patient that gets a Z-Pak is going to go out and drop dead because of their dose, but you got to be cautious in somebody that's really already at risk for having issues. What's kind of the new frontier for it? Maybe it will be good for worry. Maybe it is a better anti-inflammatory. And so right now, as we continue to give Z-Packs like water, we can kind of see how it's doing. But I think our roundtable discussion is basically, we don't really give Z-Packs all that much. However, when you go out into the community, Z-Packs seem to flow slow quite a bit, as that study showed of just how our antibiotic prescribing trends are. So does that make us right and other people wrong? Is this a regional thing? Is this a cultural thing, a societal thing? I think that that's kind of up for debate wherever you go. So I'll be interested in whoever we rope into doing the peer review of Z-Pax to hear what they have to say.
Well, I got to go to a Pfizer dinner after this. So we got to wrap up.
Don't do it, man. The steak's not that good. You can get with this, or you can get with that. You can get with this, or you can get with that. You can get with this, or you can get with that. I think you get with this, because this is where it's at. You can get with this, or you can get with that.
Hi, everyone. This is Casey Solem from Scottsdale doing another peer review. This is like the 20th time I've recorded this because I just can't seem to get it right. It's a tough topic. It's tough for me because I'm caught between what academically I was trained to do and what I know is the right thing to do versus what I often end up just doing, and then I feel guilty about it. But we're talking specifically about giving Z-Packs to URIs. So these guys did a good job of explaining why resistance matters. Of course, we're all on board with that. And of course, they talked about the indications when azithromycin is legitimately indicated, like pertussis, and that's all, you know, that all makes perfect sense. But moving on to this, because I think I was brought in as, how does a community doc approach this? And probably the most important thing I want to say about this whole thing is that this idea of the community doc is I think a little bit misleading, because there's a lot of different practice out there. A lot of different community docs I know practice on totally opposite ends of the spectrum. Although patient satisfaction tends to matter a bit more to me today than it did when I was in residency, I don't sell my soul on every case, but I also don't fight the good fight on every case either. So I know people on both ends of the spectrum. I know some of my partners who will just absolutely never, ever, ever give unnecessary azithromycin, and I know people who just give it out like it's candy. So and a lot of that will depend on what your community system is, and where, you know, what the community's expectations are, and what the hospital culture is, and what the primary care culture is, and for me, sometimes it just comes down to what time of day it is, or how many conflicts I've had that day, or what kind of mood I'm in. So it's not really reproducible, and it's not really predictable, even in my own practice. But one thing that I'll say is that over the last 6 months or so, my personal practice of giving azithromycin as monotherapy for an immunocompetent, well-appearing community-acquired pneumonia has changed. I don't do it anymore. Now I tend to add the ceftonir because I know the resistance patterns have gotten pretty high for strep pneumo. Which just leads me to an aside real quick of just this whole idea. Over the last few years, I've been noticing that ceftonir is skyrocketed in how much it's being prescribed. In fact, my own kids have come home from doctors with multiple prescriptions for ceftonir along the way, with the justification being that it's easier dosing, or it's more convenient, or it tastes better. And I sound super hypocritical that I just cannot stand that, but I'm okay, you know, tossing some Z-Packs out there unnecessarily. But I think we just have to draw a real fine line between a strong antibiotic and a good strong class that we're still really counting on for sick patients versus something that has already kind of been played out a little bit, and where resistance patterns are getting a bit higher. But I just urge everybody, just try, really think hard before you give a third generation cephalosporin to somebody. But with that said, the thing that I think is challenging about the URI patient is that they're kind of layups for us, right? They're patients that we're good at. We want to get in the room and out of the room in a single shot, and they're not the people you want to sit and spend 10 minutes or 15 minutes discussing the pros and cons of an unnecessary antibiotic. But probably that conversation could go a long way. So the discussion that I heard is that people, you know, in the podcast were saying in the community there's more of a patient satisfaction and customer service expectation. And again, that's totally debatable. That's going to be totally different in different systems. I think that if you're going to make the argument that patient satisfaction is very important in community practice, then you have to appreciate that it's not just about writing a prescription. It's about how the whole encounter goes. So these are patients that I will actually go out of my way and pull up a chair and sit down and make sure the patient feels like I listen to their whole story about every little sniffle that they've had or every little complaint that they've had, because I know that that can go a long way to them feeling like they've been heard. And at the end of it, then they might be a little more receptive to my real recommendation, which may not include antibiotics, if they feel like I've actually paid attention and I've cared. So these are the times that, at least from my practice, that I pull out some of those skills I learned in medical school of repeating back what they're saying and having a seat and the nonverbal utterances and shaking my head and all those things that we learned about but maybe don't do on a daily basis. But I think that helps me build the rapport. And then I will always have the conversation. I say, look, I think it's probably caused by a virus. You're clinically well. There are no lung findings on your exam. I think this is truly just an upper respiratory infection caused by a virus. We don't have anything that's going to treat that virus. There's no antibiotic that's going to make it better. I can write you a prescription for azithromycin, but it's probably not going to work because it's probably not even going to get to the root of the problem if it's a virus. Or if it is a small little early bronchitis or small little pneumonia that's not very clinically important, then it's probably going to get better on its own anyway, and I'd just be wasting your time and your money and the side effects of diarrhea and nausea and upset stomach, because those are things that I feel like a lot of my patients are at least aware can be side effects from these antibiotics. And if I can get away with it, great, then I won't give them the prescription. Let's say, I don't know what a good percentage is, but maybe 40% of the time I'm successful with that, and the other 60% of the time I can tell that conversation is going nowhere, and I know I'm going to end up having to write a prescription. One thing that I've heard a couple of my partners saying recently as I've been talking about this is people are starting to use the same idea as we do with otitis media, with this watch and wait. Drummond brought this up to me this week. I was down in Tucson and he brought up the idea of giving the prescription and telling people, why don't you wait a few days, and if your symptoms are getting worse or they're not getting any better, then go ahead and fill the prescription. And I think that's a reasonable approach. At least it gives me a chance to say that I tried to educate the patient. I had the conversation, and they can walk away feeling like they got the prescription, so they've got an option to get themselves bailed out if they get into a little bit of trouble down the road. I don't really have any delusion that most patients are actually going to wait. I'm sure that a lot of people just run out and they fill the prescription, but at least I can say in my heart when I go home that I didn't sell out, that I gave it a shot and I tried to do the right thing. So just a few closing thoughts. One is about the anti-inflammatory effect. I've never heard of that until I listened to this podcast. I don't know whether it works or doesn't. I'm certainly not going to give somebody an antibiotic because I think it might have some anti-inflammatory effect. There's a lot of better medicines out there like steroids that if I really need anti-inflammatory effects, I'll just use those. And then the last one is this QT prolongation thing. It's interesting because I think that the day I get burned by throwing someone into torsade, I will never again blow off QT prolongation. But it's just honestly something I don't think about on a daily basis. It's just not on my mind. But it only takes one case or one case from somebody that you know before something becomes top on your list of things that you're paying attention to. I like to think that I do a pretty decent job of catching a lot of QT prolonging medications on someone's medication list. And I would think about it before I wrote on the prescription, but it's just not something on my mind. So anyway, with that said, thank you all so much for the opportunity. I miss everybody down in Tucson, and hopefully I get a chance to come down and visit soon. All right, take care.